May it please the court, Chris Dawes, attorney number 3381. Your honors, we have a Kiowa case, and I've had the occasion over the years to have a few Kiowa cases, and they are not necessarily always the most interesting or stimulating of cases. Maybe this one's a little different. We do have a case of first impression, and both counsel for appellant and FLA did the research, and no one really found any reported opinions in Colorado or through the nation for that matter addressing this issue. So what we really have is a case that turns on construction of 5.1G of the Master Declarations for Vista. And I think you would find, if you look at that passage, it largely tracks, in my estimation, attempts to model a section that's found in Kiowa here in Colorado, which is 38-33.3-210-4B. We'll talk a little bit about how those provisions are similar and kind of track one another. Your Honors, I do have a separate blow-up of that provision, if it helps to have it in front of you.
I think we've got it, Counsel.
Okay. Thank you. What I think makes the most sense is when you look at Section 5.1G, the question is, how do we interpret this so it makes sense? How do we interpret it so that it's wholly internally consistent?
Let me ask a question before you turn to 5.1G,
yes.
Because as you point out, the statute, for shorthand, I call it Section 210 for the 5.1F says that any withdrawal has to be in accordance with Kiowa. And as you point out, 210.4B explains how that's to be done in this
yes.
situation. So why don't we just look at the statute? Why do we look at the declaration at all? Because if this withdrawal is prohibited by statute, then does it make any difference what 5.1G says?
I think that's true. I think 5.1G needs to be consistent or at least not violate the statute. I agree. And I'm glad to jump ahead and talk a little bit about the statute to that end as well.
Well, take it the way you want, but I just wanted to understand. It sounds like your position is that, yes, the statute does govern. So go ahead.
I agree. And to be sure, 5.1G needs to comport with Kiowa. And we'll talk about why I think it does. And before we jump into 5.1G, I think it's worth noting, you know, when we look at the definitional section of what's laid out in these covenants, one of the important terms is property. And property is defined in Section 1.40 as including the lots, units, common elements, and improvements subject to this declaration. So what we're talking about is basically everything in the master community of Vista Ridge, of which Filing 9, where these particular lots are located, happen to be located. But the property includes far beyond just what we're talking about in Filing 9. So turning to 5.1G, the first question I have in my mind when I look at, as I say, what property can be de-annexed or withdrawn? What does 5.1G let you do in that regard? And what it provides is it gives an absolute reservation right. It states the declarant expressly reserves the right to record an instrument, surrendering a development right, or withdrawing or de-annexing all, and here are the key words, or any portion of the property. All right, so that's what we start with, is that absolute reservation of that right. Now we read further down into 5.1G, and we know that there's a limitation. And what is that limitation? The limitation is that no portion of the property may be withdrawn or de-annexed after a lot or unit in, again, here's the key words, that portion of the property has been conveyed to an owner other than a declarant or a builder. So what that does, what that provision does, is when you go back and what becomes key is what's the portion of the property that is sought to be withdrawn. And in this case, the appellant was very careful in terms of what was seeking to be withdrawn. The appellant identified 70 lots that it owned, and that was the portion of the property to be withdrawn, those 70 lots.
But if you look at the statute, section 210.4b, it says, if any portion of the real estate, is subject to withdrawal, it may not be withdrawn after a unit in that portion has been conveyed to a purchaser. And clearly, is not filing 9 a portion? It's described, and it's in the amended declaration, it's described, it's said that it's subject to the terms and conditions of the declaration, therefore it's subject to withdrawal. So isn't that any portion of the real estate?
Well, I think you could look at portion a lot of different ways. But I think what we talk about here, whether we're looking at 5.1G or if we look at section 210, what we start with first is what's the portion that's sought to be withdrawn. And that's kind of, in my sense,
I don't think that's what the statute says, though. The statute doesn't talk about what the portion sought to be withdrawn. It's if any portion of the real estate is subject to withdrawal, it may not be withdrawn after a unit in that portion has been conveyed to a purchaser. It doesn't talk about leaving it up to the developer to decide how he wants to define portion for purposes of withdrawal.
Well, I think when you, again, when you look at 210, it's broken down into two sections. You've got section A, which talks about all the real estate being subject to withdrawal, and then B, which talks about a portion of the real estate being withdrawn. And again, in my estimation, when you apply the statute, the driver is, what is the portion that's thought to be withdrawn? I understand Your Honor's point, which is it can be something more than that. To look beyond it, but again, I think when you look at the way 5.1G is structured, as well as 210, I think the focus is on what is the portion to be withdrawn. In a sense, you can almost, this isn't an exact analogy, but it's almost like creation of a class. And when you're deciding what portions of the property are to be withdrawn, you can design your class such that it doesn't include portions of property that have been otherwise sold to someone who is not a builder or a declarant. In other words, you can shape what you're seeking to have withdrawn to fit those criteria. So for instance, if of the 70 lots that Arcadia sought to withdraw in this case, if of those 70, 3 had been sold to a homeowner, I think that defeats the deannexation effort under either 5.1G or under 210.4 because you've included portions that are not eligible. And as a result, I think the entire deannexation would fail. As opposed to in this case, the 70 lots that were sought to be withdrawn, none of those lots had been sold to anyone other than a declarant or builder.
I'm sorry, that doesn't seem to follow because you're postulating a different group when you give us the example. The 70 lots mm-hmm. are simply the group that you have designated as opposed to all of the lots that were originally there. So I think to some extent what you're trying to say is that we have to look at just the ones that you want to withdraw. But that's not what the statute seems to say. It seems to say, look at that portion of the property. To some extent, what does the property mean? Does the property mean your entire filing? Why doesn't it mean your entire filing?
Well, I think property does mean the entire filing 9 and beyond. And again, what the statute talks about is if the declaration provides that all or a portion of the real estate is subject to a right of withdrawal. And I would submit that that's exactly what the declaration provides. The key language in the statute talks about de-annexing all or any portion of the property. So again, we look at what is the portion of the property that is sought to be withdrawn. That's, in my estimation, that is the starting point. And so we start, in this particular case, we start with those 70 lots. That is the portion sought to be withdrawn.
The problem I have with that is it gives the developer the opportunity to change things as it goes along. Instead of the buyer of a lot being assured that they're going to be in a community of interest and under the statute, under the declaration, believing that they're going to be in that and that all the houses around it or so next to it are not going to be withdrawn under the hypothesis that you're posing. The developer can defeat that expectation, and thereby, I think, in violation of perhaps 33.3104, deprive the homeowner of a right that it is entitled to under title.
Well, and here's what I would say to that. One is, once that homeowner buys a unit or a lot within the filing, okay, that unit can't come out of the association. It remains subject to the declaration forevermore.
But Judge Miller's point is that it's the remaining homeowner.
And I understand. I understand that. That's the point. What I would say on that, too, is there's nothing that obligates any declarant or builder. You start out with 100 lots to build and develop all 100 of those lots in that community. As a matter of fact, I would point out in Section 5.3, there is probably a disclaimer is a good way to put it, where it talks about no assurances are made by the declarant regarding the development rights reserved as to whether the declarant will exercise its development rights or order in which such portions will be developed. And so I think that's a fair comment, but I don't think anything obligates the declarant or builder in this case to build out. And I think Kyle actually is designed to give the developer or declarant some flexibility moving forward.
Is the homeowner association obligated to pay for the maintenance of the roads that are in this portion or in filing 9, even though the builder here is deciding to pull out most of the lots?
And so the
purchasers of the new lots, therefore, can use those roads, even though they're paid for by somebody else.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the case, because, and I frankly don't know whether it's the sub-association that has the roads or whether it's the master association, whether it's filing by filing specific or community-wide. I don't know the answer to that as we sit here now. But certainly, I think if someone weren't paying their fair share, they wouldn't be entitled to have the benefits of what the association's paying for. I think that's true. And I think there are other provisions in Kiowa that provide that if you are not subject to the declaration, you're not annexed in, you nevertheless can be held responsible for certain aspects of maintenance or expenditure by an association that specifically benefit those lots.
Similarly, if this property is withdrawn, these 70 lots, what is to stop the developer laying aside perhaps zoning laws from installing a trailer park or a Walmart or who knows what?
Well, I think there are certainly zoning provisions and plat restrictions that would govern this entire development. So I seriously doubt that could ever happen. Is there a process by which you might have to go out to public hearing again and to re-entitle the property, do something differently? Yes, but I can't imagine that really ever happening here. I don't think
And they would have no recourse under the homeowner association. They would have to go to the zoning board to stop such a development.
Again, whether that could even be possible to change the, I don't know if you could change a plat where you've got a home, a development is half developed and change it from a single family residential. Maybe you could change it to multifamily, practically speaking, but I don't think you could ever change it to a commercial or other special use along those lines.
Okay.
Any other questions? Otherwise, I'd like to reserve my last minute and a half.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Michael Levy. My bar number is 25277, and I represent the plaintiff appellee, Vista Ridge Homeowners Association, in this case. I think the way in which the declarant's counsel described this and described what the declarant was trying to do makes evident the problem in the case. We've got 94 lots, and a very important fact are that in the filing, in the land records, which everyone is bound by, there is no subset of any kind. There is Vista Ridge filing number 9. It's platted into 94 single family lots. There is no other lesser subset designation of any kind, and everyone is bound by that. That was recorded prior to the declarant, Arcadia Holdings, ceding to the property, So the buyers know that. When a buyer comes in, they're charged with whatever is in the master declarations. Everybody knows that they are bound by the declarations and those sorts of things. So there is no listing whatsoever of any sort of substance, simply the 94 lots. In this particular case, and as I'll get to, the facts of this case are a perfect illustration of why what the declarant Arcadia is trying to do should not be allowed. Of the 94 lots, 8 were conveyed to residential purchasers, apparently 16 to other builders, that's not relevant, and Arcadia continued to hold the remaining 70 lots. Well, what opposing counsel is describing is sort of at the whim of the declarant. He says, okay, I've got, the market is soft now, I can't sell these 70 lots right at the particular time. Why should I pay for homeowners association dues? I'm gonna withdraw my lots from the HOA and relieve myself of the obligation to pay for homeowners association dues. And Judge Miller, as you noted, it's an utter abandonment of the 8 lot owners who are there in filing number 9, encompassing 94 lots. There are common areas, there are open space, sidewalks, things that need to be maintained in order to keep the value. Obviously, nobody wants the property to fall into a state of disrepair. And as you alluded to, everybody has a common understanding when they purchase these property that they're subject to the declaration, that they're going to be obligated to pay the homeowners association dues and therefore contribute to those common expenses. If the declarant can pull out, especially when there's no lesser designation in the land records, as you know, a shock to the 8 lot owners, those 8 lot owners are left to bear the entire expense of maintaining the common areas of this entire filing number 9, the entire 94 lots, which is utterly unfair to those 8 lot owners. Excuse me, just one second. I apologize. So I respectfully submit that what the appellant is contending is permissible. In this case, 70 lots, there's no designation, there's no sort of nothing that describes that as a portion. If the declarant had sold another 10 lots, they'd be here saying, I want to withdraw 60 lots. If they sold 20 more, they'd be here saying, I want to withdraw 50 lots. If that were permitted, the limitation would mean absolutely nothing. What Arcadia is describing here is at any time they choose, whatever works for their best interest, 70 lots, 60 lots, whatever it may be, they say, okay, it's now in my financial interest to not have to pay HOA dues on these particular lots. I'm going to magically deem them to be a portion of the property and I'm going to withdraw them, thereby relieving myself of the obligation to pay HOA dues, where everybody, both declarant and purchasing lot owners, all had a common, not only understanding, but a duty under the recorded land records that they're going to jointly be responsible for the HOA dues. Now, if there were some sort of subset recorded in filing number 9, you could imagine a filing 9A of 30 lots and a filing 9B of 30 lots and a filing 9C of 34 lots, whatever the case may be, that might be a different situation.
You've actually hit on one of the questions I wanted to ask. That's a good segue. If we agree with you in this case and your interpretation of the statute, wouldn't it give the incentive to deference to exactly what you're saying, just designate smaller and smaller portions so that they would have maximum flexibility to de-annex later? And is that in the interest of the homeowners?
I think it would not be in the interest of homeowners, but at a bare minimum, homeowners knowing they're subject to the declaration, knowing and seeing the plat and the further subdivision, they would at least be on notice that were a possibility. Is the only really answer that I can think about that. I mean, the purpose of the land records is, one, everybody's bound by what's in the land records, and two, everybody has notice of what's in the land records. So yes, I could see that, you know, a particular purchaser wouldn't be expecting a situation like this, but at a minimum, one could say that the homeowner at least had notice of the possibility. But again, those aren't our facts in this particular case, because there simply is not any further subsection. I think that's about all that I can answer your question.
Thank you.
And I think when you look at the language, in Arcadia's brief, they made a big deal about trying to focus the court's attention on needing to give the developer maximum flexibility. And I think the rationale, although I'll first make the point that, as I cited in the brief, if language is clear upon its face, construction aids, interpretive aids, such as policy rationale, really don't come into play. If the language is clear, and that's an issue of law for the court to decide, whether the language is clear and unambiguous, or whether it's ambiguous and therefore aids in construction should be used. Let's assume for the sake of argument solely that there is some ambiguity here and we're to look to the underlying policy. Again, Arcadia is urging that we look at this from the developer, from the declarant's perspective, and say we have to give this declarant the maximum flexibility, which is truly the maximum conceivable flexibility, the way they describe it. And I think the obvious purpose of the statute as sort of restated in the Master Declaration is the protection, as we've talked about earlier, of the homeowners, especially the earliest homeowners, so that they know that they're not going to be abandoned by the declarant. They know that if they buy in a section, once you know they and anybody else buys in that section, that the declarant cannot thereafter de-annex any lots in that section. So rather than focusing on giving maximum flexibility to the declarant, I think the rationale is exactly the opposite, and it's to protect purchasing homeowners exactly like we see in this case. We've got a mere 8 residential purchasers out of 94 lots, and when they know the land records don't provide any further subset, you know, they can look at the land records and see, one, even if I'm the very first purchaser, once I purchase a lot in this section, I know that the declarant cannot thereafter de-annex lots and leave me on my own to pay all of the expenses of the common areas, the common maintenance expenses that go along with the sizable property here of 94 lots. So I think that really becomes, the policy issues are quite important in that regard. I'll also submit for the court's consideration that the way that the appellant Arcadia sort of describes the language here, it just utterly does not fit with the language of the statute as further stated in the Master Declaration. It talks about a portion that there can't be any, that no portion of property may be withdrawn or de-annexed after a lot or a unit in that portion of the property has been conveyed to an owner. I know it wasn't really the contention of counsel at the argument here. The brief certainly focused on the concept of it that each lot could be its own particular portion. And I'll respectfully submit that the way that the plaintiff, the HOA, has described this is the only way that in any way comports with the actual language for the reasons that we've really talked about.
Can I ask you a question about the language of the declaration?
Sure.
In particular, the definition of the word property. You know, your opponent quotes it in the opening brief on page 11. It seems like a very broad definition. Including lot and unit and common elements. How does that broad definition work within your argument?
I don't think it has any relation to it whatsoever. I mean, the property is everything. That's all that definition is saying. The question relates to a portion of the property in 5.16, but I mean, as a matter of logic, it is axiomatic that the lots and the common areas and whatever constitute the entire property. So that's simply a logically rational statement of what property is. It means the property is everything. I would submit that really doesn't have anything to do with the question in the case, because the question is about de-annexation and whether the declarant has the right to de-annex after it's conveyed some portion. So I think that definition of property is nothing more than a simple, correct, logical, axiomatic statement. And yes, everything here, lots, open space, roads, whatever it may be, together constitutes the entire property.
Thank you.
Just the last point I'd like to make regarding the declarant's desire in this case to withdraw 70 lots or whatever it may be, 50, 60, 50, whatever the declarant may decide at that time. The practical effect in a case like this, when you've got a mere, you know, 8 lot owners, or really in any other situation, those lot owners are going to have a very strong incentive to spend whatever it's going to take to maintain the common areas. Otherwise, the value of all the properties is going to decrease. I think what Arcadia is trying to do here is basically to get a free ride and force the however many lot owners there are to pay the cost of that common area maintenance. Arcadia still owns the 70 lots, even if they de-annex them. The 8 lot owners at that point in time have 2 options. They can either bear an extraordinarily large expense of maintaining the area themselves, or they can allow it to go into a state of disrepair, disadvantaging everybody because the property values are going to decrease. Whereas Arcadia Holdings, the declarant, they still own those 70 lots, and if the homeowners pick up the slack and endure the expense of that, they're really, the declarant would be getting a free ride on the back of the remaining homeowners. So I think all of the rationale, all of the impetus goes towards protecting the homeowners in a case like this. Last point, I've seen my time is near. On the interest on the award of attorney's fees, I think that is resolved dispositively by section 7.3 subsection E of the declaration. Says, quote, a judgment or decree in any action brought under the sections shall entitle the association to costs and reasonable attorney's fees, which shall be additional common expense assessments. And then section 7.6 says interest on assessments is 18%.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. There's nothing in the desk or the statute that makes any of this filing specific. Nothing. When we look at the definition of property, it includes the entire community. We know in this case there's at least 9 filings in that community. And I say that because the association's argument really proves too much. If you accept the association's argument, as soon as there is one sale to a homeowner within the property, and that's what the statute talks about, and that's what's talked about in the decks. If you read it that way and apply it that way, then no one else in any other filing of these thousands of lots in Vista Ridge, none of them could ever be annexed after the first sale of the property is made. That's not what the statute contemplates. The statute and the covenant talk about the portion of the property sought to be de-annexed. That's what takes us back to the 70 lots in this case. And again, there's nothing that it makes it filing specific. If the statute was meant to read the way the association is advancing it here, the language would have been much simpler, and the language in Kyle would have been much simpler, because you would then say, as soon as any single lot in any filing has been sold to an owner other than a declarant or a builder, all rights of de-annexation are forever terminated. It doesn't say that. It contemplates giving the developer and the declarant flexibility. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. Case will stand submitted. We'll issue a written opinion for you in due course.